You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Radio. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the show, we have an absolute legend in the ski industry on the program. I'm talking about Mike Hatrop, and if you're not familiar with Hat, well, he starred in Blizzard of Oz alongside Scott Schmidt and Glenn Plake, and that movie really set the tone for what ski movies were going to be and for what skiers were going to be, because Mike ended up getting paid a lot of money to ski, and he wasn't a competitor by any means, and Mike, Schmidt, and Plake were able to do that and set the tone for the rest of the skiers in the ski world. So we will talk to Mike about his time in Blizzard of Oz and working with Greg Stump. We'll also talk to him about developing product for K2, as Mike was a product manager at K2 for many years. And we'll talk to him about all the ins and outs of his ski career here on Sponsored. So sit back and let's talk to Mike Hatrop. Hatrop.
How's it going?
Good, man. How you doing?
Not bad.
Where are you right now?
I'm down in the Bay Area.
What are you doing?
I'm just visiting friends, and I'll go check out the Sea Otter for a day. It's a bike race.
Okay. And what have you been up to the past few months? I know last I spoke with you was just about 2 months ago. We were in Squaw Valley. It was right around the McConkie, and your kid was beating everybody in races and then going and spinning laps in the park or doing whatever he was doing. And what have you been up to? How's your season been?
My season's been awesome. It's the best snow year that Sun Valley's had in probably over 30 years. I've been unemployed, so I skied a lot.
Unemployed? So wait, things ended with K2. I don't know if you left or however that happened, but you went to Chum's, and I thought you were working at Chum's.
I was. I was there for a year, and then that ended. So as of January 1st, I've been a ski bum.
Oh, good for you.
It's been perfect. With a new knee and an amazing season, I got to ski a ton and travel with my kids a ton, and no, it was really good to revisit my ski bum roots.
You said new knee. Did you have a full replacement?
I did. A year ago today.
No way.
Yep.
And how's it holding up?
It's holding up great. It was so painful to ski before. Last year, I didn't want to ski. So I thought either I got to quit skiing or get this replaced. And, you know, it's not as good as the original parts, but it's way better than what I had, and skiing is super fun again, and it doesn't hurt, so.
Wow, that's got to make a huge difference. I didn't realize you were skiing in pain probably for, what, the past decade?
No, but the last 5 years, it got progressively worse and worse.
Well, that sucks, but it sounds like a very expensive way to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, thank God it didn't all come out of my pocket. It's not a cheap one.
Yeah, what does that cost from beginning to end if you didn't have insurance?
I think $60,000.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, glad you did have insurance. And let's talk about just your life, Mike. And I believe you're a Seattle kid, like born and raised. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And where did you grow up? Like right in the city or the east side? Where would you grow up?
No, not the east side. Seattle. There's a big difference between Seattle and the east side. I grew up in Montlake Park, right at the north end of Capitol Hill.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And growing up, what sports were you into?
Everything. I played Little League Baseball. I played basketball a tiny bit. I played floor hockey. I played soccer. I skied.
And what were you competitive in? Because I know that you are a very competitive person by nature. When you meet you, you don't seem super competitive. But once the competitive spirit comes out in something, you are taking it pretty seriously. And I was wondering, what sports were you really serious about growing up?
Anything I played. Tennis as well. I left tennis out. But skiing was always at the top for me. Soccer was right behind that, and those were the main two growing up.
Okay, and then in terms of brothers and sisters, I know you have a brother, I think, Tim. Do you have any other siblings?
I've got three brothers. I've got Tim, and then Peter, who's between Tim and I, and Ben, who's the youngest, and I have an older sister.
Okay, and what was the pecking order in the Hatrop house? Who beat up who?
So my sister was the oldest. And I was the oldest boy, and we were all within 2 years of each other. There was a fight every day at our house. I remember watching TV shows, the entire half-hour TV show with my hand on the dial, because I would sit down and my brother would go change it, and then back and forth until we got enough. Yeah, it was nonstop at our house.
And who was the best athlete in the Hatrop clan growing up?
You know, everybody was a pretty good athlete. My brother Peter played professional soccer. He was the best, for sure.
Where did he play?
He played all over the place. He played indoor right when that was getting going. And then he played Milwaukee, played in Florida. He played in Seattle. Yeah, he was the leading scorer in the league one year and the league MVP, and he was super talented.
Whoa.
If it had been a little bit later, I said when he retired finally, if it was any other sport or any other country, you'd be sitting on a beach right now.
Yeah, your whole family would. Everybody would have money.
Yeah, exactly. We'd all be pigpiling on his success.
Yeah, but soccer at that point was as popular as croquet, and there wasn't much money in it.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, if it was today, it would be a totally different game.
Yeah. So for you, it was about skiing, and how did you first get into skiing?
My mom took us skiing when I was 11. Yeah, she introduced all of us to skiing.
And so you're 11 getting into skiing, and is it just going up recreationally, or is it getting into a race program or a bump program? Or
No, it was just going up on weekends with the family up to Alpental. We did that for 3 years. I didn't do anything competitively in those early years. It wasn't until I think I was 18 that I competed in my first mogul contest.
Whoa.
And by that time, we were at Crystal.
Okay. And then were you in a program at that point at 18?
No, we just went out and skied.
And what year do you think this is?
I think it was 79, 80.
So 79, 80, you're in your first bump contest. And then looking at your stats and your career, in 85, it looks like you filmed for Waiting for a Snowman with Stump. And Stump at that point was sponsored by K2 and Olin, so I'm sure you're one of those brands to be in his movie. But how did you meet up with Greg Stump if your first contest was in 1980 and you're in his movie in 85?
I discovered you could take winter quarter off from college.
And you're at UW?
Seattle U initially.
Okay.
And then I finished at UW. But yeah, I stretched 4 years of undergrad into seven by taking I never went to school more than one quarter straight.
Okay.
So I lived in Sun Valley first, then Squaw Valley, then Steamboat. And it was when I was competing in Steamboat against his brother, Jeff, and several other guys, Robert Aguirre, that competed on that tour, were also in Stump's first movie, We're the Droids You're Looking For.
Okay.
So I met all those guys then, and they just invited me on one of the trips.
That first trip and meeting Stump and creating a relationship with him really sets the stage for what's going to happen in your career, although you don't know it yet. But Greg Stump's a very influential person in skiing and made a lot of careers. But this is 85 and you're filming for Waiting for a Snowman. And what's that experience like? Has anybody ever pointed a camera at you while skiing?
No, I'd never shot film before. And Time Waits for Snowman was a fun movie. And I actually declined the first time he asked. I said, no, I can't do it because Nationals was coming up and I was pretty focused on trying to make the U.S. mogul team. So I turned it down initially, but then ended up going and skiing with those guys afterwards. It was like a big college road trip.
Okay.
Super fun. We cruised around to a handful of areas, drank a lot of beer and skied and never thought it would go where it went. That's for sure.
Yeah, because that's the very beginning. I guess if you have Barrymore out there and some people making films, but people really don't know of Stump yet. And he is such a strange character. Was he pretty weird back then as well?
No, he wasn't. He was much more straightforward and, yeah, clean cut, charming. He's a smart guy and he's a talented guy.
Oh, yeah, I think he's a talented, eccentric guy, but it sounds like he wasn't as eccentric back then.
No, and I was just going to use that exact word to describe him. He's become more eccentric as the years have gone by.
Well, he put together some great questions for you for this, not solicited by any means. I just was talking to him, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be interviewing Hattrip. And he's like, I've got some questions, some that I really don't even want to ask you, but I will, and we'll get to them later on after we get through your story. But always great talking to Stump and hearing what's going on in his world. So 1987 rolls around. You finally make the U.S. ski team. How big of a deal for you is that?
Well, that was huge. That was my whole goal at that time, was to try and make the U.S. ski team. So I was pretty soaked. At that point, I just had a North American spots. You had a chance to compete in the North American contest. I think there was just two of them that year. And then depending on how you did, you'd maybe get a full spot to go to Europe.
Okay. But you never got to get to that point, I don't believe, because you ended up blowing out your knee. And how long did it take for you to blow out your knee once you got on the U.S. team?
I mean, I never even competed. I didn't blow it out in competition. I was training at Steamboat. And yeah, I was throwing a helicopter, excuse me, a three, as my son would advise me today. in the bumps and was a little off axis and landed in a big hole and tried to land it on one leg, and I knew it right away.
And what did you do? Was it ACL or everything? Or
no, it was ACL.
Okay.
And then I got a Lenox Hill brace, which everybody got at that point, and tried to ski at Lake Placid. That was the first competition. It was a month later with no CL, which was a big mistake because it was rock hard moguls, as you can imagine, in the East.
Yeah.
And I ended up crashing and then tearing meniscus, which at that point, everybody thought, oh, it's just meniscus, no problem. Snip it out. You'll be back on snow in no time. And we all thought ACL was the evil thing. But in retrospect, the reason I had my knee replaced a year ago is because I had no meniscus. And eventually you get bone on bone and it becomes excruciating. And thank God they can replace these parts now.
Yeah, it's just you have to wait 20 years and the technology catches up to your body and they can fix it.
Yeah. So in 20 years, I'm hoping maybe they can put shocks in there and I can go ski moguls again even.
We'll see about that, Mike. So you blow the knee, and do you realize that you might not be on the U.S. ski team anymore after that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the bummer was that was the year that freestyle was going to be a demonstration sport in the Olympics. So if you did well that year, you got a chance to go to the Olympics. I was a huge long shot, though. There was, you know, a number of guys in front of me that were going to make it. It wasn't likely that I would go, but it was a pretty tough year. I had a slot on the team for the following year, and I started out training and getting ready to compete. But there was no financial support at that time for freestyle, and maybe there still isn't on the U.S. team. So it was a big bill to cover yourself.
How did you make ends meet?
Well, I didn't. Stump said, you want to go to Europe and shoot film? And I said, yeah, I'll do that instead.
Okay, so how long from the time you blow your knee to the time you're able to ski again? How many months go by there?
I think it was 11 months. They were pretty conservative at that point. My knee was one of the first arthroscopic ACL reconstructions, and they didn't know how hard you could push it. Everybody I knew that had their ACL replaced at that point had 2 6-inch long scars on their knees.
Yeah.
So mine was a lot less invasive from that standpoint, but they didn't know how quickly you could push it. You know, now people are maybe walking around on the knee a couple days later, whereas I was non-weight bearing for 3 months.
Oh man, but so your legs pretty much just locked straight?
Yeah, locked straight and skinny as could be. My brothers called me Half Moon Mike because I atrophied so much. So I started wearing my wallet and my left side of my pants, my left pocket, just to take up a little more space in there.
So you come back 11 months later, you realize the U.S. team's not for you. Stump offers the invitation to go out to Chamonix. I believe Plake is already out there as he's on the run from the law. And how does that whole thing evolve? Do you realize what you're doing is groundbreaking, or is it just another fun ski trip?
No, this is another fun ski trip. And Plake actually wasn't there yet. It was Schmidt and Lynn Weiland and myself. And Lynn Weiland broke her back a couple weeks into it. And that's when I said, Stump, you got to get Plake over here.
Oh, so you're the reason Plake was over there.
When Plake and I were, we met in Squaw Valley competing on the tour in 84. You know, he was from South Lake and he was quite a character, but he had a one-piece Bogner kind of stretch suit that he used to compete in. And anyways, we needed a fourth roommate for Nationals, and I was all my buddies from Seattle. And I said, hey, let's get Plake to room with us. So he did. He roomed with us, and this was the Nationals at Winter Park, and he came out. But right after that, there was a NORAM competition at Ski Acres in Washington, and it was a drizzly, rainy, brutal day. And
Ski Acres, is that even a resort?
Yeah. So yeah, Ski Acres was a resort. Now it's got a new name. It's, I don't know what it is. Ski Acres Central, I think. Snoqualmie Central.
Yeah.
Summit Central. It'll always be Ski Acres to me. But anyways, he sends me a handwritten note, and I have this note somewhere. He's got a picture of him in this Stubbies catalog, and Stubbies is a surf brand out of California. And he was in there in a drainage pipe on his skateboard with his little 6-inch mohawk. Maybe it wasn't even 6 inches at the time. But he sends me this note and he goes, yeah, great skiing with you in the rain, Hattrop, blah, blah, blah. Pass this on the Stump. I got to get on film. And I have this note somewhere.
It's like Ski Hall of Fame worthy if it wasn't in Ishkami, Michigan.
Yeah, totally. So that was, yeah, that was how I ended up introducing him to Stump. And then, of course, Blake grabbed the torch and ran.
And so he was pretty much on the run from the law when he came over and met with you guys in Chamonix, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, he'd gotten in trouble for, I think he had a bunch of mushrooms in his truck.
40 pounds.
40 pounds. That's a bunch. That's definitely a bunch.
And he was pulled over on crutches. I think he had a broken femur at the time, and he's on the side of the road in a Cadillac getting searched. The police did not find the sheet of acid or the big nugget of weed that he had in the front of the car, so that saved him a little bit of time.
Yeah, so his plan was to stay in France. He goes, what, statute of limitations on this is 7 years or whatever? I don't remember what it was, but he had it all planned out. He goes, I'm just going to stay.
And was he partying in France at that point, or did he already go like straight edge?
No, no, no. He was not straight edge yet. He was definitely still partying.
So Blake is still in his partying ways. You guys are having fun over in Chamonix, and you guys put together some great stuff on film. And when you're done shooting for that segment, do you realize when you send the footage back or when Stump flies over back to the U.S. with it, do you realize that you guys have put together something special, or do you figure you're just doing what he asked you to do?
We knew we had something special, but I don't think any of us really knew that people were going to know the name of the movie 30 years later.
Right.
You know, we knew we had a ton of great footage in the can because we had great weather, and, you know, Chamonix is such a spectacular place. We were actually scheduled to go, Schmidt and I were scheduled to go do the Powder Eights at Mike Wigley's. And I think we were supposed to go heli skiing in the Ruby Mountains, too, down in Nevada. I think Stump had both those scheduled. But he had so much footage, he said, you know what, scrap these. We don't need that extra footage. And he probably had enough footage for two movies as it was.
Yeah, and that, I won't say launched his career because his career had already launched, but that really put him to the forefront of ski movies and taking that top spot away from Barrymore at that point where all the kids wanted to see what Stump was going to put together, and the people that were in that movie were you, Schmidt, and Blake, and you became the faces of skiing and the faces of extreme throughout the world, really. And when the movie released and people started seeing it on the big screen and you became a known entity, how did life change for you, or did it change at all?
It definitely changed because, you know, I was working for K2 at the time. I was traveling to ski shops and trade shows. And
you're a desk jockey at K2, or are you a skier at K2?
No, I'm a desk jockey. I was the product manager.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody in the, I won't say everybody, but the shop floor kids all knew who you were. They'd seen the movies, and there's clinic video footage of all those as well. And so, yeah, it changed just because people recognized you, and they thought you were cooler than you really were.
Right.
But it opened a lot of doors.
What were some of the opportunities that came your way because of that movie? Were you able to do anything, say, with celebrities, go on crazy trips just because of Blizzard of Oz? Because I would think the opportunities were endless.
Well, you know, there wasn't that much at that time. I mean, the plan was to continue shooting with Stump. We'll do another movie the next year. But there was a little bit of additional money because I ended up having contracts. There was no such thing as a retainer for a skier outside of racers and maybe a few top freestylers, but people that weren't competing weren't getting paid to do it. And I mean, I was working for K2, so I didn't have a ski contract, but Oakley signed me up and Technica signed me up. So there was a little bit of additional money. I mean, it was nothing compared to what the top guys are getting now.
Did K2 ever pay you to ski, or did they just pay you as an employee?
I was an athlete as a skier. After my initial appointment at K2, K2 went through huge layoffs and I got laid off and then signed back up as an athlete about 3 weeks later.
Okay.
Which was a great deal because I worked 50 weeks a year before for X amount. And then I signed back up as an athlete and owed him 30 days for 2/3 of the money.
Yeah, I mean, there's not too many athletes that are taking desk jobs, Mike. You're one of the few people that did that. And I think what you did, I mean, you were able to help the sport of skiing as a whole because you took K2 and eventually it turned into K2 Tele and really put Tele on the map to the masses because it was out there and people knew about it. But when you put it in the hands of a brand like K2 and you have the reach that K2 does, you can really get that in front of every skier out there, and they can see what's happening on Telemark skis. And there aren't many people that want to step out of the spotlight to work on spreadsheets and ski tests. And you were that guy. And I think back then you were maybe, I won't say smarter than the other guys, but you definitely had a drive that works in an office place. You could never put Plake at a desk.
Well, I don't know that you could put Plake at a desk, but I also knew I didn't have a mohawk and I couldn't do what Plake did either. I had to do something. I never planned to be in ski movies. That was never a career choice for me because it wasn't even an option. As a kid, it's not like I'm going to be a professional skier. There weren't any. So that was never on my radar, but I just wanted to do something I loved. And yeah, if you could work in the ski industry, how great is that, especially as a young kid? So I always saw it as a great opportunity. We got to design our own skis. I mean, nobody was doing that before either. And now there's a lot of athletes that have an integral role in product development. But back then, if you were just Joe Skier, you weren't helping steer the ski collection. So that was pretty fun to do. And really, I was incredibly fortunate because of the timing of it. When we came along, I mean, there was no shape skis. There were no fat skis. There were no rocker skis. So I got to be involved in product design and direction through really the what will be seen as the golden age of ski innovation. The last 15 years have been phenomenal in what's happened on skis, and it's changed dramatically skiing. And I mean, you look at what we did in Blizzard of Oz, and Blizzard of Oz was a great movie, but the level of skiing there compared to the level today is not even on the same planet. I mean, what people are doing on skis now is mind-blowing.
I totally agree, but you look at the gear too, and that changes everything. I mean, if you had the gear that you had today back then, you know, the ability was there. You're still Mike Hattrop, and I know you'd figure out how to make the skis of today work back then if you had them.
Oh, for sure. Skis, and skis specifically have been the big catalyst there, because boots, yeah, they've improved, but it's not like they're dramatically different than they were 30 years ago. Skis changed the game, because back then you weren't going 50 miles an hour in powder. I don't care who you were. And now every weekend warrior with a pair of fat rocker skis can go Mach Schnell in powder.
Yeah. Well, I remember a line you said a while back. You were talking about McConkie, and you were saying that the ski industry at the time was looking at fat skis, saying fat skis, fat tourists. And McConkie was looking at the ski industry saying, nope, these fat skis make me go 75 miles an hour in powder. And I don't see any of you guys able to do that. So maybe we should look at fat skis.
For sure. And I remember specifically the conversation I had with Shane. We were down at Powder Magazine, and I just happened to be there at the same time he was. And we were talking about skiing, and Steve Casimiro, the editor at the time, said, yeah, but you don't get face shots with fat skis. Shane's response was, if you're getting face shots, you're going too slow.
He was a piece of work.
Oh, yeah. And he was a huge visionary.
And did you ever have any time with him? Because you're a product guy at K2. The funny thing is, you're an athlete first and foremost. You had many different roles at K2. You were in product and sales, marketing. You did just about everything there. But at the end of the day, when I had to talk to a dealer about what Mike Hattrop did at K2, I just talked about Mike Hattrop, the athlete, because really that's all people want to hear about is your ski career. And in terms of your ski career and developing product, when you sat with Shane, did you ever talk about product innovation ideas and what could happen next?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. It's funny because when Shane first came to K2, it was right after the Volant spatula.
Yep.
And he'd worked on that. And I was a little bit slower to wake up to innovation, because when the first fat skis, you know, I was like, yeah, I don't need those, and didn't grasp it right away. And then finally it was like, okay, these are really cool. And same with the first shape skis. It was like, yeah, they're cool. You can make a pretty good carved turn, but it was a little bit slower. And then same with rocker. So anyway, Shane came over and he's pushing rocker. He says, we got to do a rocker ski. My thought is, yeah, you know what? And I was talking to Patrick, who was the VP of sales and marketing at the time. And I said, Just do, let's do a concept car. We'll do one ski that Shane's looking for and make him happy. And it'll be like a concept car. We'll sell 50 of them and that'll be that.
Right.
Of course, we did the pontoon.
Best powder ski ever, that original one, in my opinion, but.
Yeah, and it changed the game. For me, it was way too rockered and it still wasn't my favorite ski, but a ton of people loved it and it definitely changed the game. And then so Shane is pushing for now we need to do one that's only 110 wide and it's got a little bit less rocker. And I'm going, oh, now we're getting carried away. And of course, we started testing more skis, and it was like, okay, these are really cool. So at each step of the way, fat skis come along, and you go, wow, how can skis get any better? And then shape comes along, and I'm like, the same thing. Okay, now you have World Cup turns without World Cup talent. How can skis get any better? And then, of course, Shane brings on rocker, and I'm saying it again. How can they possibly get better? So then Shane says, I want shocks on my skis. And I'm going, you know what? We tried that because we had had a rubber layer.
A mod structure.
No, between the ski and a binding that absorbs some of the vibration.
Okay.
It was like a little shock. And the edge hold was shitty because you lost some of the direct energy transfer.
Yep.
So I said, Shane, we tried that. And I'm just describing this rubber layer. He goes, No. I'm not talking about a little skinny piece of rubber. I'm talking about shocks, like mountain bike shocks. I want to jump off a 40-foot cliff onto a flat landing and just, And normally I would have chuckled, but I said, okay, I laughed at all those other ideas too. And that's what everything is now. So who knows? Maybe we will have those.
Okay. Your career, we could have about 20 interviews, and I'm sure with season two of Sponsored Going with Powder, I will get you on again so we can talk about more modern stuff because we kind of focused on the Blizzard days and McConkie. But I do want to finish this off with some questions from Greg Stump, as he was an innovator. He helped make your career. And while I won't say he made your career, he maybe did on the big screen in skiing. And first, he wants to know if you know why he calls you Cheshire Cat.
I think Stump calls me the Cheshire Cat because I come across as a pretty boy next door, innocent guy. And I think Stump would say that, yeah, he's the one that actually just ate the mouse, too.
He's the ringleader that people don't know about.
Yeah.
I could see that. I can see that. And then he wants to know, where and when did you climb through a liquor store window looking for Buckhorn beer?
Was that a liquor store? That was on our first movie together. That was Time Waits for Snowman. It was somewhere out in the middle of Beatty, Nevada, when we were going to ski sand dunes. I don't think it was Buckhorn beer. I think it was a fast food place. And they were slow.
Okay.
And they were turned around doing something. So I crawled through the window. And then all of a sudden I'm standing there with them. I said, can I give you guys a hand?
Like a fast food drive-through?
Yeah.
Oh, it's
Yeah,
awesome.
it's like a Starbucks window that all of a sudden you climb through and are on the inside.
That's funny.
And I think the Buckhorn comes in because we probably bought a case of Buckhorn prior to that happening.
Okay. And then, did you shit in a bathroom in Les Arcs, France, in our small condo in 1985? Because Greg Stump says that no shit made it into the toilet. There was crap all over the bathroom. And how did the Maltese Flamingo crew have the evidence to pin this poo disaster all over you, Hattrip?
Well, everybody shits in the bathroom, don't they?
Not in my family.
Where do you guys go?
I can't even talk about it on the air.
There was no evidence pointing that anywhere. I was pinned with that maybe because I had the most formidables. Formidable was an extraordinarily large beer that we were drinking. Brun, I believe.
Okay, so someone's insides exploded in the condo. No one's owning up to it, and everybody pins it on you because you drank the biggest beer.
Something like that.
Okay, I believe it at that. It's just one of those things that'll always be unknown. And the final question from Stump, and this will be the final question in the sponsored podcast: did you ever throw cutlery and dirty dishes out of a condo in France to help Greg Stump avoid damage fees?
I don't recall. I honestly don't recall, but I very well could have.
Yeah, we will assume that you did, and I would say that the last question would send us out with a bang, but it is a question that I'm not able to ask here, as I want to preserve the rest of your life, so we'll leave this one off the record. I won't ask you any more questions, Mike, but I do want to thank you for coming on to the sponsored podcast, and we will have some more on inappropriate questions in just a minute, but thanks, man. Your history has been amazing, and you've always just been a stand-up great guy.
Thanks, pal. Super fun to be on this.
So that was time with Mike Patrip, and he truly has helped shape the way the ski industry looks today, from the products that we're using to the movies that we watch, because he was in Blizzard of Oz back in the day. He set the tone for what ski movies are going to be. He set the tone for what products innovation is going to be. And that was Mike Patrip. We'll have more with Mike on Inappropriate Questions, which you can hear on the Powell Movement. But what's even more exciting is on Monday on the Powell Movement, we have Mike Jaquit, the former CMO of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. He quit his job last week, and we're going to talk to him about starting Freeze Magazine. We will talk to him about working with the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association and a whole lot more. So that's next week on the Powell Movement. As always, I want to thank you for tuning in to Powder Radio. I'm your host, Mike Powell. Thanks, and have a great week.